The combines have been running 24/7, and harvest is underway all over the state. This hour, we'll do a harvest roundup and check in with farmers who are busy in their fields. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'll talk with Mark Licht, Iowa State University Extension agronomist, Wayne Johnson, who farms near Forest City, and Tyler Magnuson, who runs a CSA near Hancock. Then, it's easy to eat locally grown produce in the summer and fall. But what do you do when the growing season has ended? We'll find out about strategies that can help you eat local during the winter months. We also want to hear from you this hour. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's harvest time in Iowa. Combines have been running day and night, and farmers who don't grow corn and soybeans are pulling in late season crops. This hour, we'll do a harvest roundup. We also want to hear from you. If you are mid-harvest, you can give us an update. If you're done, you can tell us how it went. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. In just a few minutes, I'll check in with Wayne Johnson, who farms near Forest City, and Tyler Magnuson, who runs a CSA in Hancock, Iowa. But first, Mark Licht is an agronomist with Iowa State University Extension. Hello, Mark.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
That's a pleasure.
Now, it's been dry, sunny, and warm and windy for the past few weeks. Pretty decent for harvest weather, but I want to take a look at the growing season as a whole. What were some of the challenges for farmers this year?
Well, I'd say one of our bigger challenges was just the amount and intensity of rainfall that we had. It seemed like we maybe were a little bit delayed on getting some of the corn planted, but by and large, planting season was mostly timely. You had some exceptions in southwest Iowa where, cool temperatures, rainfall kept them out. But then really we had really cool temperatures through most of the growing season. We had plenty of rainfall through the growing season, but there was more or less a gradient in where that rainfall fell. It seemed like southern Iowa got the brunt of it, and if you get into extreme northwest and northeast Iowa, they were at times just a little bit on the dry side.
So was there a sweet spot in Iowa that had just an amazing growing season?
Depends on if we're talking about corn or soybeans. So northwest Iowa was probably the sweet spot for soybean production. They grew really well, and some of the initial yield reports that I've been getting there have been really, really good yields up there. Corn yields, I would say kind of the central, north-central Iowa area seem to be the sweet spot for that.
Now, this last part of the growing season was hard on some crops. Why is that?
It was largely just because we had enough moisture really through the whole growing season. So we did have, some nitrogen movement, possibly some deficiencies in places. But then we also had an environment that was really conducive to some of our foliar pathogens, both in corn and soybeans. And so that would have taken back some of those yields in a couple places. We had even some fields that prematurely died, and that really can cut back on some of those yields.
Why would they have prematurely died?
Some of it's just because they ran out of nutrients toward the end of the year. The other part is, with the pathogens, they just couldn't withstand that type of pressure there.
Now, this summer was also notable really for a lack of extreme weather events. In recent years, it seems like we've had some crazy straight wind events, some tornadoes, hailstorms, that kind of thing. I don't remember a lot of that this year.
No, we didn't have a lot of it. We had a lot of, run-of-the-mill thunderstorms that would go through the state, but nothing that was overly severe. And that contributes to how well the crop really did grow and really came through the growing season. Again, those exceptions are going to be where we had, too much rainfall in a very short amount of time in southern Iowa.
Now, with the winds in the last week or so, are there crops that are vulnerable to high winds at this time of year?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And we started to see this even back toward the last part of September, beginning of October. Our soybeans, you know, vegetatively, they grew really well. We have reports of 5 foot, 6 foot soybeans, and they started to lodge even back then with less high winds, I would say, than we've had here in the last week. But then, you know, our stock...
And started to lodge. What does that mean?
They just started to fall over, lay down, and that just makes it a little bit more difficult to harvest them. You know, and these high winds in the last week, again, we've had, I'll say, diminished stock integrity, standability of that corn stock. And so the wind has really started to lodge and lay down some of that corn as well.
And, of course, combines are set up to harvest corn that is standing and soybeans that are standing. So if they do fall down, is that lost?
It's not a complete loss. So what it really means is that we typically have to slow down the combine quite a bit. You know, a lot of combines are combining, I'll say, in that kind of that 5 mile an hour range. And if we get into situations where we have a lot of lodging, we could be at a half mile an hour or 1 mile an hour. You know, so it really slows down that progress. But then also we tend to have more infield loss, whether it's ear drop or whether we are more or less grinding off some of those kernels with the gathering chains as it pulls that ear into the combine head.
All right, well, let's break it down a little bit. Let's focus on soybeans right now. Soybeans usually come out of the fields a little bit earlier than corn. How complete are we with the soybean harvest?
Yeah, so I did an informal survey of my field agronomists that cover various regions around the state. And there's a lot of them that are saying, you know, 90 to 100% done. Again, the big exception on the soybean harvest is going to be that southwest Iowa, south central Iowa area.
Where things just went in late.
Yeah, things went in a little bit later, maybe didn't mature quite as rapidly. And so they're a little bit further behind.
All right. And yields are high this year?
Yeah. If we get into northwest Iowa, that's kind of that sweet spot on the soybean yields. It's really common to hear 60 bushel soybeans up there on a whole field average, and not all that uncommon to hear, you know, some whole field averages up there in the 70, 75 bushel range. So that's really, really good for us in that area, especially. You come down into central and I'll say east central Iowa, yields are doing really well, probably just a little bit better than our average. And then pretty much across southern Iowa, there's just an extreme amount of variability in the soybean yields. So we're hearing some 35, 40 bushel field averages, and we're hearing some 50 and 60 bushel field averages down there.
And put prices in perspective for us, too.
So prices are, you know, I haven't looked at those particularly. Maybe a caller will tell us or tweet us with those. But, you know, commodity prices are down from where they have been in recent years. And so having these high yields really does help, you know, the profit margin at the end of the year.
How about storage with such a high yields with soybeans? Is that taking up storage that would also normally go to corn?
Yeah, definitely. And soybeans, you know, they store fairly well, but they just don't store well if you have to put them outside. And so most of the co-ops, even farmers that have some bin space, will make sure that the soybeans are, you know, in a bin or a storage structure to keep the grain quality good and consistent. But yeah, you're exactly right. If we have more total production on the soybeans, it does you know, take up that storage space that we would like to have for the corn.
All right, and let's talk about corn. How are corn yields this year?
So corn yields, again, kind of like the soybean yields, they're quite variable, especially in southern Iowa, or in some of the areas that we had higher incidence and severity of some of our foliar pathogens. So it's not uncommon to hear, you know, a field that, you know, anywhere in the state that may have 140 or 150 bushels per acre. But by and large, I would say here in central Iowa, north central Iowa, you know, hearing 200 to 250 bushel field averages is where we're at.
Wow.
But again, if we have some foliar pathogens that knock back yields, you know, we could be down. I'll say, generally speaking, we're going to be down in that 180 to 200 range on, you know, a lot of areas in the state.
All right. And when you talk about foliar pathogens, are we talking about things that cause mold or what kind of stuff are we talking about?
So it all depends on the type of year, but you know, a lot of times the foliar pathogens that we're talking about are fungal pathogens, although there are a number of different bacterial pathogens out there. Probably the big one that we've seen mid-season and carried through into the later part of the season was northern corn leaf blight. It was just a cooler year, plenty of moisture, and so that pathogen did really well. Toward the end of the season, August, early September, we started to see Antheracnose top dieback. And so that pathogen there, again, is a fungal pathogen that can affect that late grain fill period. So some of our test weights or kernel weights could be down just a little bit if those fields, really got severely affected.
How close are we to being done with the corn harvest?
So corn harvest is a little bit further behind than soybeans, but by and large across the states, it's probably all saying that 75% complete range. Again, that exception is that Southwest Iowa area. They're lagging behind. They're probably, I'll say, in the 40 to 50% complete range, and that probably carries a little bit into South Central Iowa as well.
Now, with the corn harvest, of course, we saw record prices for corn just a few years ago. We do not see record prices for corn right now. What are you hearing about strategy as far as storing corn, selling corn? What are people doing?
I think when we get into times of tight margins like this, obviously we're going to see some corn get sold, just to cover the costs from the growing season and making sure that they can get their seed and other inputs, booked and ready to go for next year. But typically when we see tight margins like this, a lot of farmers are going to try to carry some of that, especially if they have on-farm storage. They're going to try to carry that out of the growing or out of the harvest season. Because typically, once we get
the
into
prices will go up.
Yep. Typically those prices go up a little bit for us
now. But back to storage, we just talked about how we've got so many soybeans that we may not have enough storage for corn. If corn has to be left in piles on the ground, what kind of risk is that?
There is a considerable amount of risk there, and it depends on what type of on ground storage we have. Some co-ops do a very good job with it. They have concrete pads, and they get some ventilation tubes through it, and then they cover it up. Those usually store really well. A lot of times, the corn that gets stored outside in piles like that gets dried down to 14% or even 13% in some cases. And so that just helps it store a little bit better.
One of the things that we often hear this time of year is about the incredible prices that farmers are having to pay for the fuel to dry their corn. With the dry conditions we've had, is that less of a factor this year?
It is less of a factor. So, just doing an informal survey and kind of paying attention to what green moisture is doing. We started harvesting corn at 20%, and right now I'm hearing a lot of people at the 14, 15% moisture. So a lot of infield drying did occur.
All right, nice and dry. Mark, stay with us. I'm talking with Mark Lichten, agronomist with Iowa State University Extension. Coming up in just a moment, we'll check in with a couple of different farmers around the state. We'd also love to hear from you. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're doing a harvest roundup. And then a little later in the hour, we're going to talk about strategies for eating locally as the growing season ends. With me right now, Mark Licht, an agronomist with Iowa State University. And we're also going to head up to Forest City. Wayne Johnson is on the line. He's a corn and soybean farmer near Forest City. Hello, Wayne.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you for being here today.
Yeah, it's a beautiful day.
And in a nutshell, tell us a little bit about your operation.
We farm in North Central Iowa, raise basically corn and soybeans, have a DeKalb seed corn business. My son farms with me. Yeah.
So far this year, how has your harvest gone?
It's been excellent. It's been the nicest weather. It's kind of a lifetime harvest. I've been farming for about 35 years, and it's the nicest weather. We've started soybeans back the last week of September, and we haven't stopped. There hasn't been one day that we haven't gone. I'm a lazy farmer. I only work 6 days a week, so we haven't had a day off since we started. It's been perfect.
So you have all of your soybeans in. How are you doing on corn?
Corn, we're about half done. We're We probably have about 3 weeks to go yet. We harvest with 2 12-row combines and get about 250 acres a day. So that's kind of our goal, just one day at a time.
And how are your soybeans looking now that you've gotten them all in? What kind of yields did you get?
They were probably 10 bushels above typical in this area. They kind of ranged in that 62, 63 bushels an acre on a field basis. We had 5 farms go over 70, which is, you know, our typical is kind of in that 50 to 55 bushel range. So it's a lifetime harvest yield in soybeans for us.
Now, of course, a lot of people who don't have farming backgrounds drive past farmers this time of year and they see the combines growing or going, but we don't really know what happens from there. So once you get all those soybeans in, what do you do with them?
Well, there's lots of uses, but basically we store all of ours on farm, and so ours go to processors like CHS and AGP, and so we just sell to processors within 100 miles.
And with your soybeans, do you have contracts already before you start harvesting, or how do you decide when and who to sell them to?
Well, I like to have them sold for a great price, 100% sold before harvest. That didn't happen this year. I'm about 50% sold with great prices and hoping for hope for the other half. So.
And what is that process like when you're looking for buyers? What do you have to do as the farmer?
We have a good relationship with buyers, and so we'll get on the phone when we think that the Chicago Board of Trade is a decent price, and then we'll call our local processors, and it's a bid process. And so they might say, well, we're offering a 20-cent basis, and you'll say, well, could I get 18 cents? Can I get a 2 or 4 cent push on that? And no, if they don't need them, they won't give you a push, but if they really need them, they'll give you a push. And so that's what you're looking for, is kind of like an auction. You're trying to maximize price on the given day that you think that the prices are acceptable.
So right now you're not only worried about getting the corn out of the field, but you're working on sales as well.
Yep, that's an everyday, all year long thing. You have to pay attention. You're paying attention from 8:30 in the morning till 2 o'clock in the afternoon for sure, and then the electronic trade at night. So I like to sell in two stages. I like to sell basis, and then I like to sell the board price. So I try to get my basis established first, and then I know where I'm going, and then I can just pick the price when the markets come. To a goal that I might have or a trigger point, then I can just, I know who I'm talking to because I've got my good basis and I can sell to them directly.
Now, as you're harvesting corn right now, we've talked about how beautiful the weather has been. Have you had any trouble with the high winds?
So corn that's 14 or 15%, that's really dry, that seems to be topping out. So we've had 2 fields that I would say, you know, had spots in them, maybe 10 or 15 acres. And I don't know if that's because of fertility or alkali, or I haven't really figured that out. I need to go back. And it might have been spots where they were standing water. They were low spots that went down, which usually high spots would go down. And so it might have been water that just leached nitrogen away, and then that made for a weaker stock in that area.
All right, so you have to do a little detective work to figure that out.
Yep, and so our yield maps, we'll figure that out a little bit later. But for the most part, like what I'm in today, and yeah, things have been standing well so far. So
with harvest going so quickly, what does that give you time to do if you get the harvest in early this year? And of course, fingers crossed, things could still slow you down, but things are going well. So what does that give you an opportunity to do?
I've learned a long time ago that you don't, it's just kind of like anything, that things can change quickly and dramatically, and you aren't done till you're done. And so, but I plan to do, so we have some CRP, some landlords that CRP was offering more money than what I could pay for rent. And so we have about 500 acres of CRP to put in. And so I'm hoping to get that all prepared and seeded, and then we have some waterway work, and it wouldn't hurt my feelings to be done two weeks early and just get things cleaned up and put away. Basically, our process is to get stuff cleaned up and put away, and then we start hauling our crop to town, and we start kind of the last week of November and have semis that haul all winter long. So if we can, the December contract's always pushing to Christmas. It's kind of nice to get corn hauled so we don't have to work between Christmas and New Year's. But most of the time we do have to work, so maybe this year we won't.
Now, with I know that you own about 30% of the land that you farm and rent the rest. And, of course, with lower corn prices and the land prices have been historically high again in recent years but are dropping a little bit. Has that affected your rent on the property that you are farming and you rent?
It has. And, you know, for the most part, rents have been kind of going up. And each year it's nice to be able to respond to that. This year I needed to go to landlords and say it just isn't there. And that's one of the things that I think is important. In August, we were looking at, with average yields, we were looking at maybe $150 an acre loss on corn and maybe $80 an acre loss on soybeans. And so that gets to be a big number, you know, for every 1,000 acres. And but with the yields, and so we went to landlords, and most everyone was willing to back off, you know, that kind of 10. I asked for 10%, and I would say many went like $20 or $25 down, and so I was really thankful for that. My group of landlords are great and understand, and most of them have farmed, and so that's been a wonderful thing. $25 doesn't heal up a $150 loss, but it's the right direction. And if every input would do that, then it would work. But now with the better yields, I think we're going to be able to, if we took today's prices, we should be able to make $25 or $30 an acre, which doesn't sound like much, but it isn't very much, but it's on the right side of zero.
Right. Oh, Wayne, thank you so much for talking with us today.
You bet.
Wayne Johnson farms corn and soybeans near Forest City. And Mark, before I let you go, I was talking to Wayne about land prices. Are you seeing a lot of fluctuation in rental prices right now for farmers?
Definitely hearing a lot of farmers and landlords talking about this. And you know, I think we're maybe just a little on the early side to see where things go, but it does sound like they're going to come down just a little bit.
And with harvest seemingly being a little ahead of schedule for a lot of farmers, I remember last year there were concerns because the ground was going to be frozen and people weren't going to be able to spread manure on frozen ground. I mean, are people feeling optimistic about getting fertilizer down and getting a lot of other things taken care of this fall?
Yeah, there is a lot of optimism there. And, you know, we can, you know, just all those fall field activities, it takes a little bit of pressure off when harvest goes smoothly and we have a lot of time to get it done. But it also, you know, this nice weather means that, you know, we're not compacting the ground near as much with any of the fall activities, whether it's combining or whether it's that manure application or, you know, putting in the CRP acres or tiling in waterway work. So it's a really good environment to be in right now.
Well, and of course, Wayne was talking about CRP acres. We are seeing more farmers planting cover crops as well. Is that something that you're hearing about?
Yeah, and we've really heard a lot about that. It really picked up here in the last year or two. And I'd say this spring, I personally got more calls on it than I've had in the past. And then now as we're starting to see some of the crop, you know, coming out, some of the cover crops that got aerial seeded, we're seeing those fields greening up and doing really quite well. And then, you know, with the soybean fields where they either, you know, harvested them out and then either broadcasted on top or drilled in the cover crops, they're coming out and they're doing really well as, you know, as well. And again, we can just attribute this back to, you know, the nice conditions that we've had and timing's been really well.
Mark, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Mark Licht is an agronomist with Iowa State University Extension. And we're going to turn to another farmer in Iowa. Tyler Magnuson farms in Hancock, Iowa, a small town out west in Pottawatomie County. He runs a CSA with his wife. It's called Botna Burrow, and they are in their second year of production. Hello, Tyler.
Hey, good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, and I know you're in your second year, so I'm sure in some ways you're still finding your way in a lot of different ways. But how was the growing season for you?
It's been really good. You know, plenty of moisture. Some of it came pretty fast sometimes. But, you know, we had a lot of good crops, and we grow a fair diversity. So, you know, some things like heirloom tomatoes didn't do as well for us, but then we've had great sweet potato yields, or our leafy greens have been really good too. So some are up, some are down, but majority have been really good.
Now, of course, as someone who farms on a CSA, you are constantly harvesting throughout the growing season. What were some of your standout crops this year?
Well, sweet potatoes did really well, and we're still harvesting those. We had a great year for cherry tomatoes. A lot of the stuff that we grow in the spring held in really well to the summer. Leaf lettuce, different bitter greens, radishes, just because it stayed cool, and we had kind of consistent moisture. So I would say that stuff did really well for us.
And, of course, we've had warmer temperatures than normal for the last few weeks. Did that extend the growing season for some of your crops?
It did, although I think I'm seeing some stress. We had a 90-degree day, I think, last week. We haven't had really any moisture for 3 or 4 weeks. So some stuff that's in the field could use a little water. We don't have any irrigation this fall and try not to irrigate too much just because of our specific situation here. But it has allowed stuff to go. We did get a frost a few days ago, so the tomatoes and peppers are gone, but a lot of greens that really do better after a frost are coming into their own right now.
Now, again, running a CSA, there's a lot of pressure to have harvest season, not only stuff to harvest all season long, but harvest season last. Do you do anything to try to extend the season?
Yeah, we have one small high tunnel that we use, and we also use in the field row cover, which is basically like a lightweight fabric that we hold down with sandbags and little hoops over each row. And there are varying degrees of thickness, but it allows us, you know, 2 to 4 to 6 to even 8 degrees frost protection once it, you know, gets below 32. So we can hold stuff fairly well, and a lot of crops, you know, do fine. Broccoli, you know, will just stand there by itself in the field till, you know, 26 or somewhere down there, depending on the variety. So a lot of crops will stay in the field pretty long.
So comparing this year to last year, what were you able to do this year having one season under your belts?
Well, we made mistakes both years, but we've learned from some too. I think we were able to manage certain crops better. We use a lot of cover crops and have a very quick rotation with a lot of our fields. And I think just getting that kind of scheduling down in our heads and making sure that when we're taking out a crop, we know what's coming in next. You know, we get either our buckwheat in, or this fall, I think I did a pretty decent job getting our winter rye and vetch in. Those both cover crops. So working on the rotation has been one thing I've been very pleased with this year that I feel like I've made great strides and hope to get better at too in the future.
Now, with your produce, do you sell it all through CSA shares, or do you also do farmers markets?
We don't do any farmers markets because we got two small little kids, and waking up at 5 a.m. sounds like not
torture,
a great time to
right?
be yeah, with them. So we do a CSA. We do a fall and summer CSA, and we also sell wholesale to different restaurants and grocery stores in Omaha, Council Bluffs, Des Moines. We work through local food wholesalers like Lone Tree Foods and Farm Table Delivery, both in our area. And so we get out there in a bunch of different ways. Sometimes, you know, we also have individual consumers. We have a relationship who come here, or we bring stuff to them. So we're pretty diverse in how we like to sell stuff. And that, you know, allows us to move something. We have a lot of fennel in the field right now, and I was just texting with a wholesaler about selling that. So just moving it and in different places really helps us.
Well, and of course, we were talking about how prices for corn and soybeans go up and down. And of course, you also need to deal with market prices. But you also, with such a diverse farm, I am guessing you're more affected by trends and demands of your customers. Have you been surprised by a crop that seems to be in extra high demand?
I don't know. I think the whole kale situation still kind of flabbergasting.
The kale situation, I like that.
Yeah, you talk to vegetable farmers, it's just kind of funny. I mean, I like it. And that, you know, I don't know if that has peaked or what's going on with that. People still love it. You know, I think some consumers are getting into some different niche crops that farms have been offering now for a few years. I know there's a salad turnip that people really like in our CSA, and a lot of our farms grow around here that's just kind of like a sweet turnip, more like a radish without any heat, that people like. But I don't know. In general, I guess we're anchored a lot by kind of the core crops, tomatoes, potatoes, peppers, and those do really well. And then we work with individual buyers. Since we're not working a lot with direct to consumers besides the CSA, when we talk to our restaurants, you know, we're able to kind of know what they want in advance. So we planted some weirder, I guess, quote unquote, stuff that's more normal in Europe that different restaurants had wanted. And so, I don't know. We can experiment, too, and people,
and
trend, you know, the trends
Tyler,
go up and down. But
we are out
yeah.
of time, but thank you so much for talking with me today. Tyler Magnuson of Hancock, Iowa. His CSA is Botna Borough. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Eating local at the height of the growing season can be a lot of fun. It's not too hard to find local produce, and of course, it can also be delicious. But how do you keep that going when the growing season is over? We're going to get some ideas from the operator of a food hub and a chef, but we'd love to hear your suggestions, too. What are your secrets? You can email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, tweet us at IPRTalk, or you can call 866-780-9100. With me right now is Teresa Wiemerslog. She is with Iowa State University Extension, Buy Fresh, Buy Local, and the Northeast Iowa Food and Fitness Initiative. Hello, Teresa.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Glad to be here.
Now, I was just talking with a CSA farmer about trying to extend the season, and I know that's what a lot of farmers who are growing horticultural crops are trying to do. So we do see the growing season just going longer than it used to, right?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, we kind of have to do that here in the upper Midwest where it gets really cold for a good portion of the year. I've been doing food system work now for almost 10 years, and there's more and more people coming online with season extension and greenhouse production that is making local produce available for more of the year.
All right. Now, but of course, when you are at the height of harvest, I can imagine there's a lot more food than really can be sold at the time. So with a food hub, how can you help make that season go longer? What are some of the approaches?
Well, a food hub is a great way to get product to the different wholesale outlets. There's also other types of food hubs that are direct to retail, so meaning that as a consumer, you can buy directly from them. So depending on the kind of food hub you're working with will depend on how that food moves around in the food system. Now, some of the things that a food hub can do and some of the services that we've looked at specifically at the Iowa Food Hub, which is located out of West Union, Iowa, is how do we help with minimal processing, freezing product to extend it, and help farmers put in the infrastructure to be able to have more product later in the growing season.
All right. And so with more product later in the growing season, that takes us back to talking about high tunnels and things like that. I mean, with this minimal processing, I mean, we've talked about food hubs in the past, and it's a great way to make this food available in larger quantities to restaurants, and because it's kind of an aggregator. But as a food hub, do you also store the food? Is that part of the responsibility?
Some food hubs will do that. You know, the my experience is working most closely with the Iowa Food Hub, and they actually don't store too much food on site because that actually ties up cash. You know, to be able to operate the business, they will bring in food and then move it out right away. It's not an inventory type system. However, there are some frozen products that they will keep in stock available for people. But farmers, for the most part, are getting more, putting in more infrastructure to be able to store those crops for a longer period of time on farm.
So farmers may actually have a freezer section, something like that, to keep their products longer?
Maybe not the freezer piece, but definitely the cooler piece, or root cellars, types of cold storage where they're able to keep some of those crops for a few more months past the harvest season.
All right. And, of course, I know there's been kind of a resurgence in canning in the last few years with, you know, individuals canning and storing things. Are we seeing more of a resurgence in trying to do higher processing like canning with products from Iowa as well?
Yes, most definitely. A great example that we have here in Iowa that came online in 2013 is Iowa Choice Harvest. That's a farmer-owned business that specializes in freezing sweet corn and also apples from Iowa producers. Their products can be found in Fairway stores across the state, but they are one of those scaled-up systems where they have the capacity to do tons and tons of product to be able to extend that season.
Now, a lot of the conversation that has surrounded the local foods movement has been sort of a return to putting in the infrastructure that makes it possible to sell products locally. I mean, it sounds like there is quite a bit of infrastructure being built in Iowa for that.
I think that people really want to know where their food comes from. And in order to facilitate that, farmers are reacting and creating and identifying their products, not just with the direct-to-consumer relationship, but now also the wholesale relationship. So if people were looking for local produce, now that the farmers markets are starting to close for the year, you know, they may want to look at some of the specialty food stores or the food co-ops. There are two online food co-ops that people can purchase out of if they're in the Des Moines area or the Iowa City area, the Iowa Food Co-op or the Iowa Valley Food Co-op, where you can go on and online and pick out products that are still available directly from the farms and then go to a site and pick those up. Another option for some people might be winter CSAs. The community-supported agriculture model is pretty popular across the state, and most people are familiar with getting the boxes of vegetables from May to October. But there are more CSAs that are looking at winter shares, and that includes some of the storage crops, and what would that look like for certain areas.
Are there favorite things that you have, Iowa produce, that you like to eat during the winter months?
Oh, I'm a big fan of the squash and sweet potatoes. Some of the things that we've been trying to introduce into schools include things like cabbage or sweet potato fries. Some of the salad turnips that we heard talking about will still grow in high tunnel production. So there's still quite a few things you can pick from.
Well, and Teresa, we got an email from Elizabeth in Ames who says she used to eat local all season long or all year long in California. But in Iowa for the last 3 years, she's harvested apples from a neighbor's tree, cherries from her cherry tree, black and red raspberries from a friend's farm, blueberries from another farm, rhubarb, and frozen all of these things. She says she rarely buys fruit in the winter, and then she also freezes veggies to use in soups, etc. Now, that sounds like she is really working hard to make sure that she can eat locally all year long. I can imagine that's intimidating to a lot of people. Do you have some advice for people who may be a little scared of trying to process all that food themselves and store all that food themselves? What are some of the simpler ways to go about this?
Well, I'm sitting here thinking we should go over to her house and have dinner.
Yes. It sounds good.
You know, for me, I'm a busy working mom, and I do live on a farm, and we do have products or food that we grow, but it is finding the time to make all of that stuff happen. Freezing is a great way to put some of that extra product away, especially when it's in season. Put it in smaller quantities for the favorite recipes that you have. And even though, you know, the summer season might be over right now, you can still freeze and put away things. You know, roast up the squash and freeze that up. Roast up some beets or turnips and freeze those for stews and dishes later on. So you can still take advantage of extending that season so that you can enjoy the things that are ready now later on.
Well, Teresa, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, no problem.
Teresa Wiemerslug is with Iowa State University Extension, Buy Fresh, Buy Local, and the Northeast Iowa Food and Fitness Initiative. And Hans Walsh is a chef in Harlan, Iowa, at a new restaurant called Milk and Honey. And he works hard to use local fruits and vegetables in his food at the restaurant. Hello, Hans.
Hello.
Thank you for being here today.
No problem.
Now, I realize that you're fairly new to this business. Milk and Honey opened in June, but you also have a sister who runs a CSA. So you've been working really hard to use local food at the restaurant. What are some of the things that you like to use?
Yes. In the spring, when we started, and early summer, we did a lot of greens and cucumbers. And we canned a lot of cucumbers for pickles and stuff. And our menu sort of changes based on what I can get in, and I'm adjusting to that is definitely a challenge because you can't get a lot of different things in, and they can't all be used up in time to keep it fresh. So we have definitely moved towards canning and preserving, especially like jalapenos and tomatoes that have been coming in the late summer, so we can use those items like in chili in the winter and for like salsa for our breakfast burrito all year round.
So you've been doing a lot of storage lately. What are some canning tomatoes? You said canning jalapenos. How are you processing those?
Well, we're pickling them, and then we're freezing them, and we're making a lot of salsa.
All right. So the tomatoes and jalapenos together as well.
Yeah, all different kinds.
So when you're working on processing that as well as running a restaurant, does that mean that your hours just get a whole lot longer?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a challenge, but you just, you know, try to get it done when you can. Just like anything else, I guess.
So give me an idea of quantities here. I realize, again, as a fairly new restaurant, you're not sure how much you're going to be using of things, but can you give me an idea of how much you've been doing processing-wise?
Yeah, well, for example, about a month ago, we got about 80 to 100 pounds of jalapenos, which was probably way too much because we didn't have refrigerator room for them, so they were in dry storage, and they end up going bad because we couldn't process them in time. I mean, we got most of them salvaged, but it was just too much for us to handle, you know, just because they were a good deal, you know.
Right. So you were a little overwhelmed. So
yeah.
Tell me what your kitchen looked like when you were trying to get through 80 to 100 pounds of jalapenos.
It was pretty green and messy all over the floor.
And did you try to get more creative? You talked about pickling them and making salsa. Did you try to rack your brain, what can I do with jalapenos?
Yeah, because you can't use them in everything. So I'm still thinking of ideas, but basically I put them on jars and put them on the shelf, and we'll figure it out later.
All right, maybe if there are any other chefs listening, maybe you can do a little bit of a share with your jalapeno bounty.
Yes, absolutely. And actually, one of the things we're going to do is sell these items retail at our restaurant. So we made a lot of jalapeno jelly as well, and we can sell pickled jalapenos in jars right here at the restaurant.
In addition to canning and storing things up for winter in that way, are there other ways that you're trying to get ahead so you can continue to serve local stuff through the winter months?
Yeah. We My sister's business, Farm Table Procurement and Delivery, which is based out of Harlan here, I'm fortunate because she can get access to a lot of different things all over Iowa and Nebraska. So I can still get some of that stuff, with the exception of a few things, to still have these items on our menu.
All right,
like
so
lettuce salad, for example.
She can hook you up.
Yeah.
Nice. Now, for people who don't have that kind of connection, do you have a suggestion for people at home who want to extend the season and use local foods through the winter months?
Well, I would say just the way things are changing in Iowa, there's plenty of people you could probably hook up with, food hubs, we'll call them, that would, you know, help you out, send you in the right direction. There might be someone right down the road that you could get items from, and then, you know, you just need storage space, you need a freezer, and you need a plan, I guess.
Now, opening the restaurant in June, were there any big surprises for you this summer, things that you were counting on getting that you couldn't get? I mean, of course, we had a big bird flu scare this summer. Did that affect you?
That did not, because we are a breakfast lunch place, and we get our eggs from locally free-range eggs, so we didn't have to worry about that.
Did the egg prices change a lot on you, though? I mean,
yeah.
Local free-range eggs were really in demand this year.
Yeah, and actually the price didn't change for us at all because they come from my sister and her husband's farm, so they just bring them in. So they're basically, we don't have to pay for them. I mean, they just have to pay for the feed and stuff. So.
All right, so that one didn't throw you for too much of a loop.
just adjusting to the quantities and the delivery dates, and then trying to plan the menu, you know, I think is the biggest challenge.
Now, just when I introduced you and said there's a new restaurant called Milk and Honey in Harlan, Iowa, I'm sure some people thought, wow, that's a pretty small town for to carry a breakfast and lunch place. What made you want to open a restaurant in Harlan?
Well, I think the space was here, and we saw the market was here. There are not a lot of places to eat besides Pizza Ranch, Subway, Burger King.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought it was the right time to make a move and, you know, maybe start changing some people's minds and what can be done and where you can eat.
And with your approach, trying to use local foods and serve really fresh dishes, given that in a place like Harlan, Iowa, that kind of thing really hasn't been available in the past, are you finding a good response?
Yes, I'd say overall, yes. You know, it takes time. I mean, we're a small place, so we don't really want to be overwhelmed. But we definitely have some core people that are supporting our place very well. So.
And what's your specialty? What's your favorite thing on your menu?
Well, I'm a fan of breakfast burritos, and we have a brunch burger. So that is a burger with cheese, local bacon, hash browns, and a sunny side up egg on top of it.
All right.
Side of breakfast mayo.
Sounds great. Well, Hans, thank you so much for talking with me.
No problem. Thank you.
Hans Walsh is a chef in Harlan, Iowa. His restaurant is called Milk and Honey. We've been talking about extending the season, eating locally throughout the winter months, and, of course, doing a harvest roundup as well. Talk of Iowa is produced by Lindsay Moon, Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. You can email us anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'd love to hear your feedback about things you've heard on the show. We'd love to hear your suggestions for things you would like to hear on the show in the future. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.